We have to have a story.
I remember a story that I heard. I suppose with the government formation talks that, going on for the last 17 years at home, this is a story actually I heard in the Dáil Bar, right?
Now, one of them.
I didn't spend a lot of time in the Dáil Bar, right? When I would go in there, I generally used to find myself in the Fianna Fáil corner, right? Because while their politics is shite, they're generally a better crack than a lot of them, you know? Now, and in fairness to Fianna Fáil, they don't even pretend to have principles, right? Because they obviously don't have any, right? And but anyway, there was a Fianna Fáil fella telling us this story, right? They were talking about promises and all, right? And obviously an awful lot of promising going on at the moment as to what's going to happen for the next 5 years. If you could believe 10% of it, it'd be great. But anyway, he was telling this story about one was Fianna Fáil and the other fellow was a Labour fellow, right? But they were from Kildare, right? This woman went to see Charlie McCreevy, who was Minister for Social Welfare, I think, at the time. She was looking for some sort of a card, anyway, that he thought that he could organise for her, right? So Charlie said, now Charlie wasn't mad fond of doing the old parish pump stuff, right? So I wouldn't blame him. Never did any of it myself. But Charlie listened to her anyway and he says, oh, do you know what? He says, I have a great idea, Charlie says. And she says, what's that? He says, I know exactly how you're going to get that card, he says, right? Now, don't tell anyone I told you, but you go see Mr. Stagg, who was in opposition at the time.
Deputy Stagg.
And
Deputy Stagg. Deputy Stagg, the very same.
Yeah, and he says, Deputy Stagg is very good at getting these cards. I'm telling you now, guaranteed, he says. You go see Stagg, tell him what you want, and I can guarantee you're going to get what you're asked for, right? So, thanks very much, Charlie, for that. Thanks very much, Charlie. Thanks. So this is about 2 or 3 weeks later. He was walking down the street in a Kildare town, and Charlie was walking one side of the footpath, and your one was on the other side, and she puts up her hand and she says, "Oh, Charlie, sorted. Got that. Fair play to you. You're guaranteed my vote at the next election."
Well, what they did say as well is that Charlie McCreevy, who's from Kildare like me, was infamous for kind of saying that he had an arrangement with his constituents. They didn't annoy him and he didn't annoy them, so that's his way.
Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness. This is madness. We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on 3 occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say so what?
It's
the police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
The recognition of Guaido, unelected gobshite, is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and I would reprimand you over that.
So, hello and welcome back to I Foresee Trouble. This is your weekly podcast. We are on an absolute roll here in the European Parliament, popping out episodes every week, giving you an update what's happening. And I'm here with none other than your one Daly and your one Wallace. Say hello.
Hello.
How are you?
And today we'll be talking a bit about what we've been up to, what's happened during the week. We obviously have a programme for government that we want to comment on. And we have a big item on the agenda that we discussed in our last episodes that we are going to be voting on tomorrow. This is an anti-racism resolution following the death of George Floyd. So we could talk a bit about that and whatever else these two have been up to, because I know you're non-stop. So, how are yous?
Could be worse. No, how bad things are, they could be worse. You know that.
I think we're tired after the week that was in it. I mean, you mentioned the anti-racism motion, and I mean, that was on the agenda thanks to us initiating the idea all those weeks ago when George Floyd was murdered. Obviously, the protest movement was sparked then after that. So to get something on the plenary agenda, you have to kind of fight for that within your groups, first of all. So we managed to get it on. There was a motion there, and it actually entailed a huge amount of work, mainly for the staff in the groups all over the last weekend, in drafting a strong resolution and trying to get it agreed by as many as possible. And obviously our team, which are self at the head of it, Damien, were fully involved in that. And I suppose on one level, we're kind of happy that we got it quite strong. It's was the first time that the European Parliament had a resolution condemning activities in the United States, which is a huge first, given that they're criticising other countries all the time with less cause. We were very glad that that happened. And then it was quite strong on the anti-racist content in terms of Europe's historical role, colonialism, the need for all of that. We put down serious amendments in terms of the need for reparations and all the rest of it. But yeah, no, so that took a huge amount of work. What was disappointing for us then was that, having put in all the work, we didn't get any speaking time on the issue, which just goes to show how this place doesn't work. Like, you know, you can put in hours of work all over the weekend and then you don't get any speaking time at all.
Yeah, it's a frustrating place. Mm. You don't get rewarded for the work, I think, in the European Parliament. But I have to congratulate you both, because it's fantastic text. I haven't seen a text like this in a long time in the European Parliament. To get it onto the agenda, as you say, to fight with the other groups to get it on as well, it's a huge process. It's a really progressive, good title, good text. And it's actually good because the right wing left the negotiations. They were so pissed off at where we were going with this that they just didn't even bother turning up. We have the EPP group, that's Fine Gael's family, who significantly tried to weaken the text, and they were luckily outnumbered by the more progressive side of the parliament. And overall, it's an excellent text. We'll be condemning or declaring the slave trade as a crime against humanity for the first time. These things haven't been done before. We're just finally having these conversations. And then, as you said, Claire, we never criticize the United States of America. And you've made this point before, Mick, about how Atlanticist Brussels is. It's extremely favorable towards the US. So we do these urgency votes every plenary session. These urgency votes are three different resolutions on human rights issues across the world and other countries that we're obviously not allowed to talk about the USA, but we talk about all of the other ones. We talk about whatever. We had Madagascar, we had Hong Kong a million times. We'll talk about that as well. But so for once, we have something that's criticizing the US, and I think it's a really great text, Claire. Like, you've done, you can see your stamp is all over it as well. We make the connections with the prison industrial complex. We have amendments in there about Fortress Europe and about how racist the European institutions are. We'll see
the
how
the militarization of police forces in these states and in Europe, and that as well is an important backdrop too.
Yeah.
I suppose one of the striking things that came out of it for a lot of people in Europe was the fact that, you know, it costs an awful lot of money to run any state or any city. But Chicago is a huge city, and 40% of their funding is going towards policing. And obviously there's been a big call to defund policing across the states, because they've got practically too powerful, and so much money has been spent in this area without getting a proper fair police force at the end of it.
I think two things that struck me from the debate was, one, there was a really powerful contribution at the start from a German, black German woman MEP. She's in her 70s, and she told the story of how the night before she'd intervened on the streets of Brussels, that the police were harassing two young fellas. She simply took out her mobile phone to take a recording of that, as she's legally entitled to do. And then they turned their anger on her, put her up against the wall, spread her legs, tried to frisk her down. The woman was, you know, obviously saying she was an MEP, shown her passport, shown all of that.
They wouldn't believe her, of course.
And all of that kind of thing. And she ended up spending the night kind of terrified in the European Parliament. But that was just really powerful, because it just forced everybody to confront the daily situation. If that's an older black lady being treated like that, well, then for black young fellas or other young fellas of colour, you can just imagine what they experience. And it really brought it home to people. The other side of it, I thought, which was pathetic, was the right wing struggling to deal with it, and how their thing was a mixture of sort of, because they knew the groundswell was against them. Like, they were saying, well, you know, look at all lives matter, and why are we only protesting about one dead man? I mean, this other one got up and said, well, there was another black man who died and he was a policeman, but we're all anti-police now, and this is a left-wing conspiracy to just undermine the police. And their answer was, you know, well, we're proud of our background. I'm not apologising for anything that happened in the past and all of that. I'm proud to be Dutch or Belgian or whatever, and I won't be apologising for any of it, and we shouldn't be made to feel bad about our past. And if all these people are so worried, and we're saying that Europe is so racist, as everybody's saying, well, why don't they just stay in Africa then and not come here? We should be going to Africa telling these people that Europe is racist so they don't come here. Like, that was their answer.
They're not even shy about it. That's what's always shocking about the European Parliament. They're up front with it, because at least in the Dáil, like, we don't have this extreme. And like, we're actually quite protected. And when you come to the European Parliament, you're exposed to the full wrath of the right wing, I think.
Incredible.
But like, let's just have a look at this resolution a bit. So it's about anti-racism, and it takes a very structural approach to racism as well, which is what's great, because we've had a few things like this before in the European Parliament, but there tend to be quite cosmetic little thing, comments on racism about having some anti-discrimination laws, but they're not actually getting to the core of what racism is about and how it comes about and how it's used and everything like this. So the first line of the resolution is affirms that Black Lives Matter. So we have the Parliament ignoring the rest of these All Lives Matter. We talked about before, Borrell, the foreign minister for the EU, was saying about Black Lives also matter. The European Parliament is now coming back and it's just saying Black Lives Matter. It says it affirms, it supports the recent protests and following the death of George Floyd. This is a huge thing where we have the European Parliament expressing solidarity with the protesters. So this is a really big thing to be able to get the European Parliament to do this. And then we go into police brutality. We start condemning police brutality in all its forms. We call on the US and member states to address police brutality. It's just way more far reaching than anything I've seen on this before. And as you said, Claire, we have amendments about reparations. We have amendments about the EU itself and about other things to improve the text. We'll see how it goes, how the vote happens. And we'll
got a lot of amendments in the name of the group, but we did put in our own ones as well. And some of them I think are really important because they do get to the heart of the structural nature of it. Like, racism isn't just about bad attitudes. You know, we talk about colonialism, but we, and our motion deals with modern colonialism, which is, you know, the way we're robbing the global south in our unfair trade relationships, in the, you know, environmental devastation and so on that goes on. And so linking it into the economic system and capitalism, which is, you know, where it's rooted. So it's worth people having a look online and examining the text, you know. There's a lot of good stuff in it.
We'll share it on the Twitter page and you can have a look. But yeah, they'll be voted. It looks like it'll pass because it has the signatures of most groups, and we'll see how it goes with the amendments. I think one thing that you did, Claire, which was brilliant, is you got out of the text what was originally in the draft that was done by the Liberals who submitted this, was a call for more money for policing. That was what was going to happen. We were going to have a resolution that called for more money. Like, this is just completely inappropriate to say something on police brutality. We need more money to so that they can get rid of the racism. It doesn't work like that.
The opposite of defund the police, like increase their funding. Yeah.
So congratulations. I'm probably early saying that because it hasn't been voted yet, but it's a big achievement and it shows you've done a huge amount of work, and it's not going to go in vain. We have a position now adopted by the Parliament. So speaking about racism, Mick, you had a speech in the Parliament today about Hong Kong. Let's have a listen to where you made this link.
Sadly, the protest movement in Hong Kong has been hijacked by Washington-sponsored protesters who have turned justified anti-neoliberalism and corruption protests into anti-China protests fueled by xenophobia and racism. The National Endowment for Democracy, an engine of the US regime change machine, has recruited Hong Kong opposition leaders to orchestrate the protest and poured millions of dollars into them. Meanwhile, in the US, they have a brutal far-right administration that lynches its black and brown people every day, brutalizes protesters in the streets, imprisons, disenfranchises, and pushes into forced labor more people than any country on earth. There are more black people in the American carceral system today than there were slaves in 1850. This is the system that sings the praises of the violent Hong Kong protesters. This is our third plenary debate on Hong Kong. When are we going to have one on Yemen? This parliament needs to stop being a lapdog to a lawless US government.
One of the things I pointed out at the end of my speech today was the fact that this is our third debate on Hong Kong in less than a year in the plenary. We still haven't had one on Yemen. They're very selective on what we discuss in here. Europe seems to be pretty obsessed with everything China, from what I can see. And any excuse at all to bash the Chinese is taken advantage of. You have on the right wing in the parliament, there's that anti-Chinese bias. And then in the so-called liberals, of which is a kind of, there's a big chunk of them in the middle sector of the politics, you would say. And they are obsessed with this notion of human rights and humanitarian intervention. And in actual fact, both human rights and the notion of humanitarian intervention are used as tools to almost undermine countries, undermine existing governments. They're tools of regime change that the Western powers often use. And we've reached a stage where every time you hear the word human rights in here, you have to kind of almost question it. Whereas, you know, of course, we're all in favour of human rights, but the manner in which political groupings use and abuse the term human rights and humanitarian intervention. I mean, look, truth be told, the whole notion of humanitarian intervention has lost a lot of its gloss, but it was very, very popular up to a few years ago. Libya was obviously a big blow to it because I can't even remember, we were in the Dáil at home at the time in 2011, and the number of politicians in the Dáil that were in favour of taking out Gaddafi, even if it meant destroying the country. And of course, the French and the Brits drove that with the Americans. It was a NATO intervention, and they literally did destroy the country and brought anarchy to the place to such a degree that the slave trade is back there. And obviously, it's also linked to the fact that so many people have died in the Mediterranean since. But so much of Northern Africa has been destabilized from this. So they've been probably less inclined to talk about humanitarian intervention a bit since that. It kind of put a bit of manners on them. Human rights is still being used and abused for the same purpose.
No, I mean, I thought one of the key points you made, which I thought was really strong and what was really interesting, was that Mick was a lone voice in this, like, you know, absolutely minority of one, like, you know, and completely on the opposite side.
But this is in the plenary debate.
In the plenary of where potentially hundreds, well, obviously not hundreds, would get in on the debates. But it's so important to put an alternative view and, like, to point out, as Mick did in that speech, about the role of the United States in funding, bankrolling, arming, you know, with information and with money, pro-democracy movement, as it's called, you know, to sort of for its own political ends. So the weaponization of human rights is well underway, been ratcheted up, very proofs of detailed links between the far right, these people who would be against the Black Lives Matter protests and that, linking in with the leadership in Hong Kong, and yet the same people who were up to crying one thing in the motion aren't joining the dots on the other. So it's really important that Mick had the opportunity to spell that out.
Yeah, and so a few of our listeners will be listening to this and thinking, well, do you not care about the human rights situation in Hong Kong, or What's your point there then?
Well, I mean, we care about human rights everywhere. But we're just pointing out the fact that the right wing in Europe and the so-called liberals are jumping up and down talking about human rights in Hong Kong and about, oh, how brutal the police have been. I mean, they actually, this week it was interesting that they actually didn't talk about police brutality in Hong Kong, because what's gone on in America has put it in the shade. And in actual fact, the Chinese police force have actually been pretty conservative in their actions in comparison, big time. And the Chinese have been conscious of the fact that they're being watched, of course, as well. Right? Well, listen, we're not saying that everything is perfect in China. Nothing is perfect in any country. It's just some are worse than others. But they use these opportunities to attack the Chinese. And we don't agree with that. There was, in the first week of protests in Chile against the right-wing government there, there was 21 protesters killed.
Yeah.
There's only one protester has died in Hong Kong yet, and he didn't die from the police, right? It was an accidental death, right?
Was the thugs with a brick, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, so in actual fact, there's no comparison with what's going on in Hong Kong and going on in other areas.
That's a very good comparison, because we also made a request as the GUE group, the left group in the parliament, to put a resolution and debate on Chile when we had these protests last December, which is the reason why we didn't go to Chile in the end for the COP. We made this request to put it on the agenda, and it wouldn't go on because we couldn't get support from the other groups. So the parliament doesn't have a position on what happened in Chile. No human rights urgency, as they're called, the resolutions where we condemn Chile for this, that didn't happen at all.
Yeah, and listen, if you're going to talk about protesters and natural protest and the people taking to the streets for one reason or another, let's keep in mind that in this situation here in Hong Kong, Endowment for Democracy, which is actually an arm of the American regime change machine, right? They have admitted pumping $22 million into the protest. Now, I mean, that's political interference.
Pro-democracy movements, what do you have to say about that? Because that's what people are thinking it is, or they're listening to this. Oh, pro-democracy, this in Hong Kong, they all want democracy.
Well, if you follow what's really happening in Hong Kong and the leaders of the protest now, they're not actually looking for any particular autonomy or self-determination for Hong Kong. They want Hong Kong to be closer linked to US business interests. That's what they want. And they are making no secret of it. This protest movement, which did start out in a totally natural way, it was actually protests against neoliberal policies that were being implemented in the place. And they were rightful protests, and they were a natural progression by people looking for a more fair deal. But these protests have been hijacked.
And it's timing. Like, why is this on the agenda now again for the third time when, as Mick says, countries like Yemen, which are being devastated, haven't been discussed at all? The situation in Afghanistan is utterly heartbreaking. Again, hasn't been discussed since we've been here in any serious way either. And then we had the affront on it as well, that while they're going on about respecting human rights in Hong Kong and giving solidarity there, the parliament had a chance this week to make a stance in relation to the continued and increased violations in international law by the Israelis, with their announcement by the new government of the imminent annexation of one third of the Palestinian occupied West Bank, starting any day soon. And yeah, we moved a resolution to say, and we, you know, that under these circumstances and in the supposed tradition of respecting international law and encouraging conflict resolution, that we shouldn't ratify an agreement which the European Union was about to sign with Israel, and European Mediterranean Aviation Agreement between the EU and the State of Israel. Now, we made the point that the agreement had no practical implication, because it's been applied since 2013. But to publicly ratify it now in the context of the announcement is a boosting for Israel in a bilateral sense, against the tradition. We don't normally do that. We put the vote down to it. It was our idea again. And I think it was don't know what the vote was, but we lost, which is shocking.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Let's listen to what you had to say when you were moving this request.
Grazie, Presidente. Yes, I would like to support the request to postpone the vote on the ratification of the Euro-Mediterranean Aviation Agreement with the State of Israel. This ratification has no actual practical implications, as the agreement has been provisionally applied since 2013. But to adopt it now, in the context of the announcement by the new Israeli government of their imminent plans to annex one third of the occupied Palestinian West Bank in flagrant breach of international law, is of substantial symbolic and political importance. To ratify this agreement now
would send an inconsistent message from the European Parliament. It would be perceived as an upgrade in bilateral relations with the State of Israel, a positive for them, and a complete shift in the EU's long-standing policy of linking any upgrade in relationship with Israel to progress on conflict resolution. Clearly, this latest move from Israel is only going to accelerate the conflict and the hardship on the Palestinian people. We should not normalise Israel's violation of international law by ratifying this agreement now, and I'm asking colleagues to please support the postponement of this decision.
So that's Claire speaking in the plenary to make this request happen, and the vote, as you said, was shocking.
I actually thought, after listening to Claire speak in the plenary, I thought to myself, you know what, maybe we could win this one. 102 out of just under 700 actually voted with us, which is really disappointing.
Yeah.
Now, and in fairness, it should be said, right, EPP are by far the biggest group in the parliament, and obviously they were completely against Claire's motion, right? But it should be said that the four Fine Gael MEPs voted with us on that motion. So credit where it's due. And it's nice that they're keeping an eye on us. So that's good.
No, but what is interesting
Staying
is
vigilant.
That all of the 13 Irish MEPs from all political groups voted for the postponement, which shows the scale of the sentiment in Ireland, keeping them in check. They know that public opinion in Ireland would be on the side of what we were trying to do, because people in Ireland are outraged at the behaviour of the State of Israel and want to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Unfortunately, it didn't carry with the rest of them. That's something that actually we should be glad of, that all the Irish reps felt that heat of
well, they felt the heat of you, I think, you maybe.
Know, it's good to see, you know.
Yeah, look, unfortunately, successive governments at home haven't been as strong as they should have been on the Palestinian issue. Mm. And they're behind the curve on the issue as far as we're concerned, because the majority of the Irish people are very much aware of the fact that the Palestinians are getting treated abysmally by an apartheid state of Israel. And it's about time now the politicians did catch up with what the people feel on this matter. So, yes, it was definitely good that all 13 MEPs voted on the Palestinian side on this occasion.
And they're going to have their chance now with the new government, with the Greens and Fianna Fáil, who have promised to support Francis Black's Occupied Territories Bill. So let's going to see. Is that in the programme for government?
No.
Haven't heard much of a mention of it. Did they say they're not going to do it?
Wait till I tell you. So it's actually quite interesting that we have full support of this motion just to delay an aviation agreement that's already in place. We have full support of that from all the Irish MEPs. And yet we have nothing about the Occupied Territories Bill in the programme for government. So have a look at what's in Palestine in the programme for government. It's a big fat boo, basically, because all we have is honour our commitment to recognise the state of Palestine as part of a lasting settlement of the conflict. We've had this for a long time now. And we have a commitment to fund the United Nations Relief Work Agency for Palestine, UNRWA. That's no news. We've been supporting it for ages. Everyone around the world does. And so nothing on the Occupied Territories Bill, which is interesting, because if Fianna Fáil and the Greens were supporting it, it's obviously something Fine Gael were very much not wanting to have in this programme for government. And to be honest, it's really, really upsetting, because, as you said, Claire, this is something with such huge public support. It will be Ireland actually leading the way on international solidarity with something that is just legally sound, that we should not be importing products that are from illegally occupied territories, and that's not even in the programme for government. And so the Greens are now asked whether to sign up to this or not. That to me is an absolute deal breaker.
I think it's very significant that Fianna Fáil and the Greens, if they go into government, are prepared to turn a blind eye to this, the same as they're probably going to turn a blind eye to the US military continued use of Shannon. It makes me a little bit worried about what's coming down the tracks. I don't actually see a mad amount of change in the next 5 years, given what's taking place at the moment, and this is a real symbol of it for me.
It's very clear from just analysing the media or just skirting through it. Obviously, we're at a bit of a distance, but there seems to be a major green love-in or a media bombardment of, oh my God, this is a green programme for a government. When did we ever see anything as green as this? Which is obviously an appeal to the Green Party membership to make sure that enough of them vote into thinking, well, this is great, we better sign up for it, and then they get a government in place. But it does seem to be, you know, big on aspirations, but not really. You know, it's very much greenwashing, giving an appearance of stuff that's either already there or will be done anyway, and making it out to be a lot more than it is, from what I can see. Whereas on key issues, which if you wanted to make a difference, the likes of Palestine, but even Shannon Airport and that, I think the Greens will do what they did the last time, if they go in and if they pull it off.
But like, you're dead right about this media campaign to absolutely shame the Greens into going into this. Now, of course, the Greens have to vote. They have to get two-thirds majority of their members supporting this deal, which is a big threshold. We'll see what happens now. The vote's open. But the campaign by the establishment to push them into this is absolutely huge. And they keep using this language, like you're saying, of the green fingerprint is on every page, or there's a green, big green impact, or they're punching way above their weight. They only have this amount of MEPs, but look what they're getting. They're getting away with murder. They're making us do all this. It's just a bit much, because like, look at some of the basic things. Like, we have EU Mercosur, which we've talked about before, and we'll be talking about, of course, in more detail, because it's a big ongoing issue here. Like, that is an extremely clear-cut issue for a Green, or supposed to be Green, because Ireland has the ability to block this whole trade deal going ahead. If we do not, if we oppose it, it's not going to happen. That's how trade works in the European Union. And what we have in the programme for government is, quote, carry out an economic and sustainability assessment of the headline EU-Mercosur trade agreement to inform future actions in this area. So not only is it just to think about the sustainability of Mercosur, which we know is obviously not sustainable, can't be greened, but it's actually even about informing future trade. So like, it's complete waffle. It's actually worse than what you could even expect.
Yeah, and I think it should be pointed out that it isn't long ago, a few months back, I heard Fianna Fáil say that they were opposed to the Mercosur deal. Now listen, it's not rocket science. It would be very good for farming in Ireland if trade deals like Mercosur didn't happen, because they undermine Irish farming. Now, so while on one end, we have the Greens and Fianna Fáil going in with Fine Gael, and they're content enough now with Mercosur to go ahead, despite the damage it does to Irish farming. And on the other end of it, the Greens have not made a red line issue over reducing the dairy herd, which everyone on this planet knows at this stage, the island of Ireland has too many animals on it. And if we are serious about dealing with our emissions, CO2s, methane, achieving the targets without addressing the dairy herd is going to be incredibly challenging. And then, on the other hand, to actually allow Mercosur to go ahead, it just doesn't make sense to me.
And it is interesting. I mean, a lot of the focus, and obviously the media are giving the Greens an easy ride, but the position of Fianna Fáil is hilarious as well in this, because, you know, on the one hand, we're being led to believe that this was actually now a master strategy by Micheál Martin, who kind of understood that Irish politics is under evolution and was going to be much more like European countries all coming together in some furry little middle coalition. And he foresaw that with the confidence of supply, and he's going to be the Taoiseach now. Did you ever? I mean, the reality, if there was an election now, Fianna Fáil would be utterly hammered. And, you know, Eamon O'Queeve was absolutely correct in his commentary, saying this is game over for Fianna Fáil. It is an open page now for Sinn Féin to come in and take them out with them going into this agreement.
As you say, he's walking now into the Taoiseach's office now after 9 years being leader, failed leader, terrible leader. He's now walking into the office. So they get away with it. And like, what can you do at this stage? And it's the Greens are asked whether they're going to support this or not.
Yeah, I actually thought that that Varadkar would be tempted to go to the country again when the COVID thing had calmed down, because Fine Gael would definitely have robbed a lot of ground from Fianna Fáil. Fianna Fáil were actually on the floor, and he's actually given them a kiss of life. By going into government with them. In relation to the dairy herd, right, some farmers have been on to me saying, oh, listen, you'll destroy, you're always defending family farms, but you'll destroy family farms if you reduce the dairy herd. And I said, well, my point would be is that the small farms, the family farms, are not the ones who need to have to reduce their dairy herd. It's the big ones that we need to bring back to normality, as they've got off the Richter scale. It's the industrial level of farming in Ireland that needs to be challenged and brought into kilter with the environment challenges. It isn't the small farmer that has the too many cows. It's the big buy.
And I think it's, you know, and it's not just we see, so basically on anything we've seen, there's nothing there to tackle big agriculture. There's nothing there to really transform the situation in terms of the environment. But equally, there's nothing there in terms of workers' rights or that whole area. I mean, what is going on post-COVID? In some companies, you take aviation, for example, with the absolutely vicious attempts by the big airlines and aviation companies to stand on its head rights and conditions that were fought for over decades in the most blatant and vulture sort of behaviour. The silence on those types of issues is incredible. Like you take like we are an island economy. Connectivity is very important. Aviation will always be important to Ireland in a way in which maybe to other non-island countries it won't be. And there was and is an environmental challenge that needs to be dealt with there. But now into the mix, there's a cataclysmic workers' rights problem because we see the likes of Aer Lingus, who were held up as an alternative to Ryanair, basically copying or even being worse than the behaviour of Ryanair and what they're doing to their staff. Like they're forcing them in essence to go down to about 30% pay. A deal has been put to them saying you either accept this at home in your own house, isolated from your colleagues, or else we're going to let people go. I mean, it's the same thing that IAG, who own Aer Lingus, did with British Airlines. They kind of wrote to 4,300 pilots and said, we're going to either accept this now or we're going to fire the whole lot of you and we'll rehire you on self-employed contracts. The same self-employed contracts that Ryanair, Buzzair, all these companies across Europe are using now to basically force workers to pay back their wages over the next couple of years. And let's remember, these companies have got millions from Irish taxpayers in COVID relief wages. So it's the taxpayer who's been paying the wages of these workers, including the workers themselves, who are taxpayers too. And now these companies want workers to pay back that money over time. They want to bring in work practice changes that they've wanted to bring in for years. They've been hoovering up the money in terms of cargo operations. They've had to put on extra flights to deal with the level of cargo. We know Ryanair had 4 billion in cash. IAG had about 8 billion sitting in cash. They haven't had to dip in or use any of this. And now they're getting workers to pay their own wages back. Same CityJet letting go all of its pilots. And I think it is important for people to say, I mean, people have often looked at pilots as a privileged group of workers, but we should remember that for people to be pilots, and particularly recently, a lot of these people have had to pay huge amounts of money to get their flying hours and to essentially pay for that flight training. And when you get to a certain stage, if you don't keep up your skill set, your capital or your ability to fly is actually eroded. So you have people who borrowed a huge amount of money thinking they were investing in their future in a inverted commas big good job, like, you know, now facing the prospect of nothing and those huge debts behind them. And you've had loyal cabin crew and pilots who've worked in aviation for 20, 30 years now being asked to basically live on the breadline. And not a word out of any flipping politician in Ireland from what I can hear.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think on the positive, I mean, the behaviour of the unions have been disgraceful as well. I mean, SIPTU were basically saying to their members, oh, we're not going to show you kind of what's in the deal and we're not going to have a vote. You just accept it or it, like, you know, you just, there is no choice. Like,
the point was been made even early in the crisis that very often workers' rights and conditions that took years to get, it only took hours to get rid of them. I mean, that's really scary.
I suppose on the positive side, though, there is, and I mean, there's been a groundswell of support. We would work well here with the European Cockpit Association, who, you know, work with the likes of IALPA, the Pilots Unit Home in Ireland, and others. But there have been grassroots movements of pilots now springing up on social media, which in the course of the last week now across Europe have had 6,000-7,000 members joining, arguing for, you know, action from the bottom up. And that's the only way in which we will challenge this, is for workers to organise themselves, which is incredibly difficult in Ireland now, because Ireland's still in kind of lockdown. The rest of Europe has come out of that a bit more. We're obviously a lot more freer now, but that is the only way. And challenging the hold that the union bureaucracy have in not really representing people enough. It's not good enough that they would bend over like that. And I'd really like to see more from the unions in terms of challenging this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, the thing is, we're actually facing multiple crises at the moment. And like, you pointed to one that's completely underrepresented in the media, of this workers' rights crisis that we're actually facing now. And now the one that we do get a bit on the media now lately because of the green wave is on climate. And we were saying just about how it looks, it's sold as if this is the big climate program for government now. And they call it the Green New Deal, which is a bit embarrassing because it's anything but. We have the 7% figure that we've heard about loads, but the wording around it is just waffle. It's about saying an average 7% per annum reduction in overall greenhouse gas emissions from 2021 to 2030, which means nothing until we get to 2030, where we already have an EU target for 2030, which is going to supposed to be way more than the 51% that they've mentioned here. It's supposed to be at least 55%, and we're trying to get it to 65%. So there's a commitment to actually sub-target goals, and the 7% isn't even in any way accountable. It's an average over a 10-year period. The government obviously doesn't last 10 years. And there's no time where we can actually point the finger at the government and say, you're failing on your obligations because you're doing
so opposite. If the government falls after 4 or 5 years and they've made very little progress on the percentage, they'll just say, oh, this is a 10-year project. So in actual fact, they can get away with anything in the first in the 5-year government.
And they're signing off and saying this is the green print on the...
And I'll tell you about something as well that should... listen, as we were very much involved in opposing the Shannon LNG. We were probably shouting and roaring about it before a lot of them. And obviously now everyone thinks that it's a done deal. Well, that's gone now anyway, that's gone. Let's see, right? All I can see for the moment, I see that it's been taken off the PCI list next year, right? Which will probably just mean that the state won't be able to give it money. But if a private entity comes in from the US, eager to go ahead with this, get cheap frack gas from America or some other way for pharma doing it and sell it to new data centres, let's see what happens.
When I looked through this programme for government, the thing that hit me in the face is how many things are stated here as new commitments when they're already obliged, legally obliged to do these things. And no one in the media is saying, look at this waffle in this programme for government. They're writing things as if it's new commitments. They're talking about climate neutrality 2050 as if that's progressive or somehow ambitious. It's the same category or same target that Hungary has. Mm. Poland is nearly there. They're all. It's not in any way ambitious.
It's a betrayal of the green activists and the people who voted for the Greens thinking that they were doing something positive for the environment. It's terrible.
And just even these other commitments, like even the small details, which you look at and you say, oh, that's lovely. That's a really nice idea. Like about having water fountains around the place. That's a legal obligation because of the European Union Drinking Water Directive, which we're going to vote soon. It's actually, they're obliged to do this and it's in there as if it's something new. The same thing for all things about circular economy, about waste. All of this is already legally obliged and no journalist is saying, look, this isn't something new. And all we're getting is journalists shoving this programme for government down people's throats and saying, get a move on and get into government.
Unfortunately, we saw Sinn Féin were the largest party in terms of support, public support after the election. I actually think it is a serious blow to democracy in Ireland that neither Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael would even talk to them. That doesn't make sense to me for people who say that democracy is important. Given that they were the party that got the most votes from the people, how in God's name, who says that they can just ignore their existence? Now listen, Sinn Féin weren't automatically entitled to go into government because they didn't have enough seats. But when you think that there'll be communication, how dare they say, oh, we're not talking to yous over there. You stay over there in the corner. You're toxic, or you're this, or you're that. Oh, you're too left-wing. Oh, you have a Republican past, an army past. Come on. For God's sake, an army passed. Fine Gael had the blue shorts fighting with Franco in Spain, and Fianna Fáil, they carried guns into the Dáil the first day they went in. They were throwing stones at Sinn Féin for a military past.
I don't think they'll be ignoring them too much longer now, because if this government gets its way and is formed, given the economic difficulties post-COVID that we're going to be facing, I think Sinn Féin will be in the position of being able to say, listen, you know, be an opposition, and we'll see how they deliver on that. But I do think that things aren't all bad in that, like there were, and we do make a lot of play about the media being instrumental in public opinion, because sadly they are, but there was a very interesting, I think it's kind of reaching its limit in some ways. There was a very interesting study by one of the French newspapers, which actually changed what has been the practice. So it brought in, it told its journalists, it recruited, say, 100 extra new journalists, and told all the journalists that they wanted less copy out of each of them. So more staff with less work to do, because they said, we want you to concentrate on quality and do some research. And the sales of that newspaper have begun now to change. They've bucked the trend, because people do want more analysis and they want more research. And one of the things we will be putting to the new government, which is what we said to our fellow MEPs all those months ago when there was going to be an election and we thought we would have had a government in February, was that one of the things we're leading here is a demand to the new Minister for Arts, Heritage and the Gaeltacht. We will be going to head up a delegation of all of the Irish MEPs to demand that there is an Oireachtas TV for the European Parliament, particularly now post-Brexit. There's no point in depending on RTE or, you know, the private media to cover the European Parliament yet. All of the things that you just mentioned there about that are in the programme of government that come from Europe, the issues that we deal with every day here that come from Europe that are affecting the lives of Irish people, and they do not cover them. So we need that to change.
No, it's the very governance and the very structure of so-called independent media that makes it impossible to actually critically look at the establishment or critically look at the document like this and be able to come out with something that's interesting to read. Like you were saying, Mick, about LNG, like the wording around that, it was told to us in the media as if there was a huge promise, commitment to never do this. But if you look at the wording, it's actually a bit shoddy, and there's a good few loopholes there. Like, it's about just framing it in terms of fracked gas. Would it be acceptable if there's some justification that it wouldn't be fracked gas? Do you know? So there's a lot of investigation work that's not happening here. And you make the point as well, Mick, it's been sold to us like it's an ultimatum. This or nothing, or we have a political crisis. How many times are we hearing now that if this doesn't happen, we have a political crisis? The political crisis is from the beginning of the exclusion. Do you know? So there's these invented crises that aren't tackling the real thing. And like, just, we don't have time to talk about the whole thing, of course, but one thing we have to talk about in the programme for government is just how it is a commitment to neoliberalism. It's something we love talking about. We bring it up all the time. Neoliberalism, neoliberalism, neoliberalism. But the people need to know that this isn't a radical document, and it's been sold as if it's some sort of transformative radical one. It's the same economic policy we've always had. It's austerity, the same corporate tax rate, which we have, which is half that of other European countries, a shift from taxing labour and capital to shift to taxing consumption with sugar taxes, carbon taxes, you name it. That's literally classist. It's about enshrining neoliberalism into this. We're heading into an economic crisis. We have no way to fund a Green Deal. There's no extra taxes on high-income earners' income. So I just think that whole macroeconomics of it, there's a huge lack of analysis from environmentalists. The environmental NGOs are just as bad because they don't look at this. Mm. They're interested in the little details. The cycling lanes, the walking expenditure.
1 million a day. Yeah.
But how do we fund a Green Deal? And they have the audacity to call it a Green New Deal, and then no economic, an austere Tory kind of plan of how we do this. And it's going to be the people, the workers, who are going to be paying for this. And it's just...
Well, it's interesting that you brought up neoliberalism there, because I had two econ committees this week, and the subject came up at one of them where there was two experts in, financial experts, and both were talking about the fact that neoliberalism is a problem, because whenever there's a crisis, we actually abandon it, and we put the wonderful free market on hold while we look after the people, and the state looks after business to keep it going as well. But then we go back to normal when all the dust settles, and the state the state is literally picking up the can for neoliberalism now. Listen, we're glad that the state is helping out, right? Especially with the people, with the wages. It was a great idea. Helping, and I certainly hope that there's really serious help for small business now, because when they reopen, they're going to be very challenged. If people think that it was only because they were under pressure when they were closed and the workers had to be carried through it. When small businesses open now, with the restrictions, with the downturn in business, with less people working, no tourism, there's an awful lot of small business going to go out of business unless they get serious help. And it won't be coming from private banks. The state is going to have to look after them. But it just emphasises once again that neoliberalism is a failed policy, it has failed on a number of occasions now, and we do need to go in a different direction.
Yeah, that's it. And that's what screams to me in this programme for government. And I can't believe there's Greens who consider themselves left who would think that this is an acceptable programme for government. It's not.
But hopefully you won't.
Yeah. Now, I have a final question because we have to wrap up. But I'd just love to know what the two of you think of Ireland now getting this UN Security Council seat, especially in the context of us knowing that the Occupied Territories Bill is out the window. Is Ireland going to be this bastion of hope and the beacon of light and human rights defending? And what do you make of it?
Well, for most of my life, well, I'll tell you what, certainly since 2001, we have proved ourselves to be a total puppet of the US regime. And is that going to change now? Let's see.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it interesting that all during COVID, when Shannon Airport was shut down, only the US military was transiting through it? Like, we've damaged a lot of our cabal. They may have gone around, you know, licking in the right quarters to get their seat at the table, but I think the payback for that is that they're not going to rock the boat.
Yeah, that sounds like it. Anyway, that's it. That was our 16th episode of I Foresee Trouble. Get in touch with us on Twitter @I Foresee Trouble, and I hope you have a lovely day. Chat soon.